Good morning, Mother Earth. Thank you for all your abundant gifts. Good morning, Father Sun. Thank you for feeding all living things on Earth. Thank you, Plant Kingdom. Thank you, trees and plants, for converting the sun's light into edible foods that we can consume and digest, and for providing oxygen in the air that we breathe. Good morning, water. Thank you for being 75% of our body. We are one, and we bless you and protect you because we cannot live without you. Good morning, Animal Kingdom. Thank you for your companionship, your beauty and splendor, and for your sacrifice of life so that we may eat and live. Thank you, Great Spirit that moves in all things. Thank you for our lives and for the opportunity to be here and to be of service in this sacred earth garden of life. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Hello and welcome to Shaman's Keep, the show that offers you a glimpse into the mysterious world of the shaman. My name is Caroline Wise King. I'm your host. And each week we will explore some different avenues of shamanism. We will have guests from all over the world, many different cultures, many different perspectives. But basically, they all do the same thing as far as healing work is concerned. Today we have one of our most unusual shaman. We have Michael Dunning, who was born in Scotland, and after a series of experience with elemental spirits and some death-defying health problems brought on by some of these experiences, he was healed by a very ancient female yew tree. And he spent 9 years studying with this yew tree, and which she imparted much wisdom and shamanic knowledge to him. So this is a rare opportunity to hear a man speak who has literally been trained by a tree in healing from a shamanic perspective. So, Michael, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Shaman's Keep.
Thank you very much, Caroline. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Well, No, our guests are going to be thrilled with your story. Would you tell us a little bit more about how you came to encounter this yew tree and how it taught you?
Well, you and I have talked about this before, and it's quite a big story. And the yew, in a sense, represents not just a single tree. So I'll say this first just to give a sort of context.
Okay.
It represents, in a sense, a lineage. And to me, it has an ancientness to it which links up to very early conditions of our Earth and our planet. And it seems to retain those conditions. So it has incredible abilities to rejuvenate itself, to regenerate itself, this individual tree, because it's connected to this deep lineage that goes right back to the early Earth conditions when life forces were much more abundant, much more accessible. And it has retained the power of these early life forces before they were diminished. And it's probably the only living being that is able to call forth forces that are original, that stream through it. So it's an incredible being. And I often link it to our early embryological nature, the way we come into the world, where we have abundant forces and then we gradually, those forces become diminished as we go through life. So there's a connection there that I've been exploring. So for me, coming to the tree was a long, arduous road. And it was 87, and I was finishing art school and left art school and went looking for the artist's way, as I've talked about before, and it was quite a naive life in a way, sort of a little tiny studio in Edinburgh, and expecting the world to come to me, and suddenly I would be producing, having shows and showing my art. Of course, what I'm really saying is that one can't make any money doing that. So in the course of looking for employment, I ended up in the very north of Scotland planting trees, ironically, very close to a nuclear reprocessing centre called Dounreay, which is now decommissioned. And the reason I bring that up is because this was a time, really just a year after the Chernobyl disaster, and the earth had been shaken by that event, as we know. And that area, of course, is still off limits there. It's a ghost town, and it's created a lot of problems. Our atomic technology, going awry. So up there in Thurso, the name Thurso means Thor's River. It's very north of Scotland. Very, very kind of depressed place at that time. It's probably a little bit better now. I was planting trees in the middle of nowhere with my friend Ewan, and Ewan means yew tree. And I've told this story many times, and we can go back. You can ask me things about it if I miss anything out. But this place was in the middle of nowhere. It was very, very dark, very denuded earth. And it was one night where I was seized in the middle of the night by an extremely powerful force that I woke up basically choking, unable to breathe, and a pressure from all directions on my body, right through into my cells. It was a crushing, crushing weight, almost like being under an enormous weight of water. And I was unable to breathe. And the atmosphere was in a tiny caravan, a very dilapidated caravan. And the air had become so thick and almost fluidic, it was impossible to breathe. But I realized in my panic, in my blind panic, that I was inhaling a thick, viscous, acrid, burning vapor. Vapor is liquid, which was sulfuric. Mm-hmm. And this was a very, very, as you can imagine, I very quickly felt that almost instantaneously that this was the end, and there was that kind of toxicity, and being in the presence of that kind of toxicity there's just a knowingness that the human body is incapable of handling that, and it's amazing how quickly you, one, accepts that. And I began to realize that there was something more to this. Amazingly enough, in the state of absolute terror and panic, there was a sense of an intelligence orchestrating the movement of this viscosity and this pressure and this sulfuric quality. And I realized that there was an intelligence outside of the caravan and also inside of myself. And I'd never encountered anything like this, and I actually haven't ever since to that extent, although, as I'll talk about a little bit later, perhaps this being that I call the elemental self or being was not evil, as it turned out. This being had a certain purpose to fulfill, and my sense was, that this being was very intelligent. And so I was crawling my way through the caravan, wanting to encounter whatever this intelligence was. I mean, it was very clear this was the end of my life, and with the last bit of strength that I had being crushed down onto the floor, I decided to crawl my way along. I must encounter what this is. I must know what it is that is taking my precious life from me. And I managed to pull away the door of the caravan and looked out into the blackness. Of course, I could see nothing with my eyes, but there was a sense of this enormously powerful breathing presence that had seized hold of the entire atmosphere and was breathing me as well. And I did feel that there was a moment where I passed into this whole other realm, this a realm of death, really, a place that really we you know, don't understand in our culture. We fear it. And there was a doorway open to me, and I had no choice, in a sense, but to go through it. And as I went through it, there was a sense of a transition and a sense of a return, if you like, the sense of this creature, this being, coiling back as though it was about to strike, like a sort of coiled serpent, and then enormously loud pop, a bang in the atmosphere as it pulled back, and I collapsed. And so I went through this moment of death, and then was given life again, and came back to life, and gradually over a period of a few hours, my body began to return to normal, which to me seemed miraculous, considering that a few seconds before, a few moments before, I had been in the grip of something which was a death force, without any question. And then to be given life back, to have gone through this, what later I realized was a transformation. And the next day I got up and I looked around, and there was nothing, no sign of any footprints. Of course, why would there be? And as the event was happening, of course, I was thinking of radiation, as was very up in those days. You know, everybody was thinking about these things then, and I was very concerned. And I just at that time, oh my goodness, where that radioactive plant has exploded or something. It's another Chernobyl. We're all going to die. And as I woke up in the morning after this awful night, there was no sign of anything, and everybody else was fine. There were a few people scattered around in other caravans, and my life was never the same after.
And none of them had experienced any of this?
Not a thing. Not a thing. Yeah. None of them had experienced this. And, you know, I am going to be writing more about this in more detail, and there's much more to say about this.
Well, none of them had experienced it. It sounds like an absolutely terrifying experience.
Yes. Very demonic. It seemed it. But in fact, it wasn't really that way. There was a certain order about the experience, and an order to the entire experience, especially in the sense of being drawn from there, drawn down to this incredible tree, this yew tree that you introduced so beautifully at the beginning of the show.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well. I'm interested in the fact that you said at following this experience, you suffered ill health and thought that you were going to die from the results of having had that experience, that somehow it affected your physical health. Tell us a little bit about how that happened, and did you go to doctors? Were they able to find anything wrong with you?
I did go to doctors. You know, having been run with tests and realized there's nothing wrong. They couldn't find anything.
So they couldn't find anything physically wrong with you, but you felt sick and that your body was not functioning right.
My body was really basically not functioning at all. It was sort of moving further and further from my grasp. It was very, very difficult to fulfill any simple task, and walking even just a short distance was just so incredibly exhausting that I was really becoming very infirm and losing a lot of muscle mass, and basically my body was dissolving. There was a certain sense of a dissolving of the body, as though the mineral qualities of my body were being sort of consumed or burned up, which is actually a function of sulfur. That the old alchemists would talk about. So in many ways, looking back now with a little bit more, obviously I've spent years now looking at this since 1987, of course I wanted to make sense of this, and I've gone very deeply into that, and I understand now that the function of sulfur is to dissolve, is to burn up the mineral, to consume, and to dissolve form. So there was a quality of my form, a sense of my form being dissolved, being completely moving out of my grasp, and with that, my consciousness was changing sulfur tends to put the consciousness to sleep. It tends to extinguish consciousness. So there was a quality of everyday consciousness that began to get extinguished. It began to become subdued and submerged. And another consciousness began to kind of emerge, which was a very different and very alarming consciousness that seemed to be, to some extent, existing outside of me, outside of the range of the consciousness that I had had before. And that's a very alarming experience, as people might imagine. And I describe it as a peripheral consciousness, a consciousness which is more about a peripheral space. It doesn't feel, it's not a consciousness that feels as though it's emanating from the inside. It's a consciousness that feels that it's coming from the outside. And that was causing me a lot of problems, where spatially I couldn't orient myself. I couldn't orient myself to time any longer. I had no sense of time, very little sense of space. I had no sense of the earth beneath my feet. It was very difficult to actually maneuver through time and space. And all of those dimensions began to get distorted and twisted and pulled out of shape. And other dimensions began to enter through that consciousness, which I had absolutely no framework for whatsoever. And so I was basically waking up inside of a new consciousness without having any framework for that whatsoever. No human teachers, no community to help me with
right.
that.
Right. You know, that is actually a very common element of what happens to a shaman. They meet someone or something happens in their life that shocks them out of the reality that we have been programmed to live in, and they have to put it all back together in a new consciousness. That's one of the initiatory elements that is part of becoming a shaman. So how long did this go on before you actually, shall I say, met the Yutri?
Well, the experience at Thurso began in 87, and it was really until, it was probably 93 before I really was drawn to the tree. I had been drawn to an area of close to Edinburgh by the sea, and had no idea that this tree existed there, but clearly I had been drawn there. And there's a lot more strands to that story that probably we should leave for now, but I was drawn to this space, and the person who was who'd decided to, thankfully, to look after me — I was incapable of really looking after myself by this point — I had one day mentioned that I should go and spend some time, you know, with a local tree surgeon, and who was a notorious drinker in the area. This is where the Scottish qualities of the story begin to become through. But I say that with all respect for my country. But we went to this little bar, and I hadn't really been out much for a while, and you know, alcohol was involved. And before long, the tree surgeon declared that we were going to go, and he was going to introduce me to the yew tree. And I had no idea what he was talking about. I had no clue what a yew tree was, or where we were going, or what he was even talking about.
Yes, since you were both inebriated.
We were both
tell
inebriated.
Us a little bit
yeah.
more
let's,
about it.
Let's be honest with everybody who's listening here. Yes, that was the case. And there was some moonlit light that night, so it was a kind of beautiful, actual evening. And he drove us. I say drove us, and then we found our way to this old Victorian estate. These tall, beautiful red bricked walls of these old Victorian estates, and with the vines creeping all over them. You know, the estate had become dilapidated since the 1950s. The estate had just gone to rack and ruin, really. So we climbed over gate, and we went through all this overgrown plants, and as you know, the Victorians were collectors, so there were sequoias in this land, and there were all kinds of incredible plants and amazing trees. And of course, we go through all these different little tunnels and branches and places, and we find this, it takes me to this incredibly big black shape, enormous black shape, with an even blacker hole at the bottom. And he gets behind me, just pushes me straight into this hole. "Off you go," he says. And I thought, what am I getting myself into here? And I crawled realizing that when I tried to stand up, I was pierced on all sides by this what appeared to be a tunnel of living wood, living branch, and I mm-hmm. pushed my way through and realized I had to pretty much crouch, crawl 40 feet through this rising tunnel, this rising long tunnel into this open enclosure, which actually was the tree itself, entirely encased, entirely enclosed, one way in, one way out, just like the original idea of Solomon's temple. And this whole basic living wood temple of this tree, which on its outer circumference is 400 feet around, it marks an enormous area. And I was in the presence of what I realized immediately was a divine being. And I felt absolutely awed and staggered, and I felt that I'd come home. I had finally found what I didn't even know I was looking for. I had been drawn and led to this place, and I knew it. I knew it in every cell that this was where I needed to be. And the following day, I went back with a clearer head, as clear as my head could be in those days, of course, and was immediately seized by convulsions that was the beginning of a healing process. And these convulsions lasted for on and off for 3 years as I went through my first phase of being healed by the U, which was a very visceral experience. So the tree immediately began to work on me. It had been working on me all of the time, but I obviously had no knowledge of that. But immediately being under the tree, things began to change rapidly. Things began to shift very rapidly for me at that point.
Oh, that's fascinating. Now, you say that you studied with the tree or sat with the tree for 9 years, during which time it taught you. How did it teach you? Was it telepathic? Or how did the tree communicate with you?
In many, many different ways. It's a tree of living gesture. And there's a certain overall wholeness of its gesture in the way that it grows back down into the earth and continues. And as you know, most trees, they grow out, upward and outward towards the cosmos. They're plants that are open, and they want to, it's almost as though they want to return to the cosmos. Their leaves are open for the sunlight. Everything's opened up. But the U has a very interesting gesture in that it grows upward, and then it enfolds space, almost like an animal, almost like a creation of an inner space that more of an animal-like nature would have. And there's a certain quality about the U which has an animal-like intelligence, an organic kind of more of a sort of animal-like, human-like almost intelligence, where it folds space in on itself, almost like it you see in embryological development, to create an inner space so that a new development can take place. So when you're inside of this chamber, this is really what is an initiatory chamber, things begin to happen. And I realized very quickly that the atmosphere under that tree was sealed. There's a sealed quality to going in there. There's it has a whole other atmosphere to it inside of its space that is sealed off from the external environment. And I know now that the U bark gives off a hallucinogenic toxin, which changes consciousness, an alkaloid changes consciousness. And so very, very quickly, I was being drawn into these incredibly, I was being basically taught how to come into relationship with the peripheral consciousness that I mentioned earlier, how to come into synchronization with it, how to work with it, how to wake up inside of it, how to become more in control of it. And the U spoke to me through its gesture, through drawing me into itself and drawing me out into its chamber and out into its... So basically I became, in a sense, one with the tree. It sounds kind of corny to say that, but I was actually already drawn out into peripheral space, and the U basically, almost as though I was walking into the spiritual plan of what a human being really is from a spiritual point of view, that the U represents a kind of an archetype of a spiritual plan of a human being in a bizarre way. Now, that sounds like a big thing to say, and there's a lot in that, what I've just said.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, it was like stepping into our nature at a different level and being able to begin to exercise oneself and being able to wake up inside of an expanded understanding of what a human being is in relationship to this divine being, which is really what it is. It's a divine being. Nowadays, they're not even really regarding it as a plant anymore. The botanists are stumped by it. They don't know how to categorize it. So it really isn't a tree as such. It's really, I say, it's a placenta of a god. And you know, that's something we could talk about in a little bit. So for me, though, that was teaching me through this sense of being able to help me to fulfill some of the initiation that had already begun and to take it further by pulling me into this peripheral space, into this peripheral consciousness, and teaching me to wake up inside of it. And the way it did that was it worked with what I call the light fibers. And the light fibers were kind of the thought, I say now, the thought of the you, the thought of a divine being. So these light fibers were, in a sense, they were like sort of cosmic thoughts or divine thoughts being sort of shown under this tree that, in a sense, entering my body, or I was becoming one with this light. And I often say when I'm doing my workshops and things that the human thinking is a cosmic light that has died, mm-hmm. and that there's an iron light that wakes up inside the blood that we're given as a human, and the yew tree is called the iron wood, and it's really connected to an expanded function of our blood that we haven't really fully understood yet. So to go back to this cosmic light, this light fibers under the tree, were, it was like an intelligence speaking to me under the tree and talking to my body directly, talking to my viscera, drawing things out of what was left of my body into peripheral space, reforming it and bringing it back in. So having studied now embryology for many, many years because of these experiences, it was the only language I could find nothing in. Eventually, when I understood what shamanism was and I looked at books, nothing I knew of, nothing that I saw had any language that was of any use to me. When I understood the basic outline of shamanism, the basic outline of initiation, and that was helpful, but there was absolutely nothing there that was really able to speak to my experience directly. But I found my answers in looking at how we come into being, how we come into embryological becoming. And that shed a huge amount of light on my experiences. I realized that there was a connection between the early development of human beings before they come into finish form and the function of this tree. And that goes right back into the occult teachings. I mean, I found out since that this is something that was known. This is not a discovery that I've made. It's something that I've rediscovered. But this was a knowing that was that the ancients had already understood. And
yes, in ancient times, they venerated trees as great cosmic beings. In fact, the Celts worshipped the yew tree as the goddess, the great goddess of all life.
Exactly.
And so this is very fascinating. Now,
yeah,
working with the light, you didn't mention the light before when we talked. And my experience in growing spiritually many years ago when I first learned to meditate and be able to connect with the Great Spirit, this is what happened to me. This blinding white light would come into my consciousness. And when I opened my eyes, even in bright sunlight, it seemed dim compared to this blinding white light that would seem to come upon me and fill me and inform me in ways that words cannot express. And it brought a sense of wisdom and oneness with this divine creative spirit that seems to permeate everything in creation. So you experienced the light when you were under the tree. Did you feel the light was coming from the tree or was penetrating from elsewhere?
Well, I mean, yeah, thank you for that description. That's beautiful what you were saying. I love that. And the light from the tree, it seems as though that sealing off of that space, of that inner initiatory chamber, and if people want to go on, you know, on my website, they can see, they'll be able to see images. It's always very useful to look at images. It's very hard to, when I do my talks, I'll often first of all do a slideshow, which I don't really like to use technology, but it's actually useful in terms of projecting images, and people are just awed by this being. So seeing the being then makes a lot of what I'm saying, it helps it to make more sense. So mm-hmm. So this cavern, this chamber of living, breathing wood, seals off an inner space from an outer space, and it, to me, there's a space where a chamber where sort of divine light can be brought into this earthly dimension in a way that is so there's an illumination in that chamber, and mm-hmm. it's through a sort of series of light fibers, almost like a living web of light fibers that weave themselves under the tree, very much in a similar gesture to the way the tree actually grows. So when you look at the tree itself, it's not, I always say this to my students, is it's very important not to kind of look at the tree and then try and jump into another reality. It's actually the tree itself and its gestures is a teacher. And it's mm-hmm. important that we see that the you is the earthly image of a divine being, that we can learn from it. So in a sense, these light fibers, in a way, mirror the growth gestures of the tree as kind of divine thought processes, as divine ideas that enter into the human being and sort of light us up, as you said yourself, this kind of sense of this incredible illuminated consciousness penetrating your being. And for me, these light fibers were also very healing. They started to reshape and make my body. So there was a quality of being able to begin to regain some strength and some vitality as well as being kind of woven. A new body was being woven for me out of these light fibers, because the fibers would also enter into my body. And at times that was very painful, actually. It was like piercing light moving into and piercing into the body at certain nodal points that, it seemed to be fairly random. I mean, you know, there were certain places where you could say there was correspondences between key nodal points or acupuncture points or something like that, but there were also points that were not corresponding to that. So there was a incredible intelligence at work remaking my body. So I was able to gain some more strength, and there's a quality to the work that I call New Shamanism, an essence of the five trees, which is really about really following the principles, the spiritual principles that are unfolded by the yew tree. And we cannot do that through our thinking brain. We cannot use the sort of logical consciousness to do that. We must continue to wake up inside of this other consciousness. And to me, this is the great teaching. What's unfolded by the yew trees is this waking up inside of this other consciousness and continuing to work with that as a spiritual principle given from the tree. So there's qualities of working with the what we might call the body, working with the organs, working with the blood, working with the bone, working with what we're given, and the language of that, but working into it in such a way that it actually reveals to us our original nature, which is what, in a sense, we look like a little bit more when we're a tiny little embryo before we really have a body. And that's a part of the story. So we become, by doing this work, by working in New Shamanism, or working what I call the essence of the five trees, we basically begin to rekindle a shape of the body that we had in the spiritual universe. There's something there that we begin to wake up back into and perhaps reclaim it as a new form of consciousness or a potential way forward. And this reclaiming of this peripheral consciousness, of this body, this other body, that the spiritual body, I call path of the dragon body. This body I call the dragon body. And a lot of the work I do is really about following the holy path of the dragon body. I've been able to walk this path to bring some of this original knowledge forth into the consciousness that we that we are trying to birth, a new consciousness we're trying to birth.
Well, I have so many questions. When you talk about the essence of five trees, are there other trees besides the yew that you include in your teachings?
In a sense, no. The essence of the five trees is goes back to is referenced to Irish myth, where this figure Fintan, who is reputed to have lived for 6,500 years, similarly to I mentioned, we talked about this before, the old king lists, where the old kings would live to over 30,000 years or so, and the actual lifespan diminished gradually as the earth changed. But Fintan was this figure who had been around before the Great Flood and could recount all the events of Ireland. He knew, he had seen all the races, the peoples coming and going to Ireland over the thousands of years. And he is given a divine branch, a branch of three fruits by a giant, a golden giant, who hands him this branch and instructs him to plant this branch. And he plants this branch, this Fintan, character Fintan. And Fintan actually means red tree, or it can be translated as red tree in some cases. And the red tree is the yew, and the yew is really the red tree. So Fintan and the yew are very, very, very intimately bound up. And the branch of three fruits represents the yew berry in its different stages of development. So Fintan plants the yew branch, the branch of three fruits, and it grows into the. He plants basically from that. He plants the five sacred trees of Ireland, and these five sacred trees of Ireland have. There's been a lot of confusion over time, and many people think that only two of them are yews and others are oak and things like that. But it's pretty obvious that they were all yews, and there's a fair amount of evidence to back that up. And you know, friends of mine in Wales, Janice Fry, Alan Meredith, Janice has just written a book called The God Tree, all about this and all about the yew, and I actually wrote the foreword to that book, outlines some of this. So now there are a few of us working on these things. So the five trees comes from Irish myth. Mm-hmm. And to me, the essence of the five trees represents this coming from a divine source, this origin from a divine source. So, to me, that's the meaning of the five trees, is being able to rekindle and return and remember to wake up to a divine knowing.
Yes. Well, I believe trees do carry that divine wisdom. And of course, other cultures like the Norse myth tell that humans were created from an ash and an elm. And, one was created as male and one was female, but they were created from those two trees. And there are other cultures that also have trees that they venerate as the tree of life. But you believe that the yew goes back, its lineage goes back even before those trees existed, perhaps?
Yes, it does. And you know, when we go to the north, for example, there's the needle ash, which was, many ways the ash was regarded there as being very purple. But there may be some confusion there, and there was a word in the kennings, in the Norse kennings, which were kind of riddles, the needle ash is actually really the yew, and because the ash is not evergreen, and it's not known for its longevity. So I think there was some confusion over time, and what we're really realizing now is that Yggdrasil is actually a yew, and it wasn't anything else but a yew. And when you look into the Norse mythology, the yew is everywhere. And I mean, to be honest, there's not really any argument it's very difficult to argue against that now, because there's just so much there around references with the Yu to Asgard, to the ancient gods, to Heimdall.
Yes.
Who was born of nine mothers who are Yu roots or Yu branches. So it's really everywhere. And when you look at the Yu and you look back to the ancient gods in Eridu, which was the original Eden, what became the Christianized Eden, the original Eridu, the Sumerian Garden of Eden, if you like, where you've got Enki, Ea, who plants the Nemes and the Kiskanu trees, these two trees. It's likely that these trees were used, because there's other words for Nemes tree that Erin and Eretz and Aretz, a few words that actually mean you. And the word Ea, the name Ea, shows up in the Hittite as around about 1750 BC. You see this word showing up, Ea, which was a word for the you. And it meant to be touched by eternity.
Wow.
So you see these early gods, what were called the flesh and blood gods, Enki and Ea, as having a direct connection to the Hittite word Ea, which means you. And also, Ea gradually morphed into Yahweh.
Oh.
And Yahweh and the you are very, very closely linked. I mean, as is Jehovah. And there's a lot of writing has been done on this, particularly in the 19th century, and there's many connections with the old Irish language, and Yehu or Yahu, very similar to Yahweh, and those who are interested in languages can take this a bit further. It's a big story, but the Yu and Yahweh are really one and the same, and of course Yahweh Elohim, this fourth Elohim, who was a sun being and sacrificed himself to become a moon being, was really this movement of a divine being who decides to experience death and come into this earthly plane as a gift, as a sacrifice to allow basically consciousness to arise, to this the potential for human beings to begin to develop, for life to begin to develop as such, and consciousness to begin to develop. So there's this notion, my sense, and I'm crowding a lot in here into a short space, so forgive me, but this movement of this Yahweh, you being, this divine being who comes down into this earthly plane as a flesh and blood god in order to kind of birth the possibility of a new consciousness. And I think that is what one of the earliest significances of the Yu was. It was known that the Yu was extremely significant in the origins of human beings, the origins of life. And it was carefully guarded and protected because of that, because it held certain key mysteries to that would be unlocked in the future. They would not be able to be unlocked until later, and they would give an offer, possibility of a way forward. That sounds like a lot, but the U was destroyed deliberately many times. There was an attempt to eradicate it completely. And the U was linked to the Grail. And the Grail saints were planted U trees. They carried U staffs. Mm. Jesus himself had a staff called the Bacal Isu, which was called the U staff of Jesus. And when we look at esoteric Christianity in that strand, we see that the pagan, the pre-Christian knowledge of the Yu, there was an attempt to take that forward through the Christic lineage, through the esoteric side of that. But of course, the Roman Church could not accept that side of it and the pagan origins of itself. So that was sought to be. They sought to obviously eradicate that and eradicate any connections with the Grail and all of the rest of it, as we know. So what you see is the Roman Church covering up its origins and trying to annihilate any trace of the former Christic lineage that was too pagan for them. So, and even in 14th century, the last one of the U staffs, the actual staff of Jesus, which had been handed to St. Patrick and had been used to found many early churches, the Irish churches, which again, Rome shut down the Irish church too. So in their attempt to do all of this, they also burnt they burnt the staff of Jesus. In the 40s, Archbishop Brown burned it as a superstitious relic. Now, that tells me everything, that they wanted to eradicate the entirety of the population.
Well, everything pagan. They chose to most of the holidays that are Christian celebrated holidays were actually dates that were pagan celebrations, and so in order to eliminate the pagan, they picked those dates and made them Christian holidays. And yeah. So, yes, a great deal has been changed by the church.
Very much so, and very much so. And you know, the holy hermits who came from the Holy Land with few staffs brought them back to Wales and Ireland and Scotland and planted them. And these ewes still exist today in Wales. And
wow.
That tells us that there were certain strand, and they were called the carriers of the sacred branch. The keepers of the Grail, they were also called. These holy saints, who were not canonized saints, these were saints who were not regarded as saints. Some of them were even military. They were trained. They were highly trained, also in the military. These orders of saints, if you like, brought these branches back from cuttings from ancient trees, yew trees that existed in Lebanon. Now, yews existed in Lebanon up until about the 18th century. So these trees were brought back from the Holy Land and planted in Britain. And Joseph of Arimathea brought one such branch back as a staff. And when they did an excavation in the chalice well in the 60s, they did not find the chalice. What they found was a yew stump 11 feet 6 down, which had been planted just at that time after Christ. So there's a big story here that was attempted to be suppressed, and there was a very conscious attempt to maintain a knowledge, to carry a knowledge forward, to continue this, the branch carriers. They were preserving a knowledge that is linked to what was attempted at the crucifixion, but it's a knowledge that goes way, way, way back, and it's a knowledge that dare I say, is beginning to wake up more. And I think my initiation represents an aspect of it where you know, I was perhaps shown some of this knowledge, and part of it was rekindled. And you know, that sounds like a lot to say, and I don't mean it to sound pompous or over important, but there's a certain knowledge I have given from the yew that I feel is important, and there's a need to continue this lineage, this carrying the branch forward, because the yew has a very important place for us. It was a very deep root in pagan practices, much more than we realize, much more than we realize.
And they live for thousands of years if humans don't interfere and cut them down. We don't seem to have many yew trees in the United States. Why do you think that is?
I think there are possibly many of them were destroyed. They're very sacred to the Native Americans, First Nations up in the Pacific Northwest, some of which are not even, you know, unless you're part of you are First Nation, so many of these trees are protected. You're not allowed to see them. So there are Pacific yews that are venerated and protected, and the mother trees there. So some of this lineage continues at Pacific Northwest in its own particular way. I was recently up in British Columbia, and I was doing a workshop up in Salt Spring Island, and I was taken to an ancient yew strand standing on a beach. I think it's a male tree, and it stands between two bodies of water. It sort of guards the sea, and it stands on a bed of seashells almost. It's raised up, almost like you're looking at the an exposed part of what the tests or the shells of ancient sea creatures. You know, it's quite amazing. The locals say that all the shells represent the cast off shells of that were eaten by the locals and just thrown on the beach, and gradually they built up into a strata. But I think there's more to it than that. And this tree is ancient there, so there are some really ancient trees. Some are accessible, some are not. So it continues that I have yet to make any contact with the First Nations people to find out, you know, to share knowledge and to talk about this, because this is a story that was much more global than we realize as well. It wasn't just in Scotland and Ireland.
Yes, I believe you really need to do that. I read somewhere that the pharmaceutical companies have discovered that there's a potent anti-cancer drug that can be made from the bark of the yew tree, and that these companies depleted most of the trees in the United States back in the 1980s, harvesting that for their drug work.
That's correct. Yeah, I mean, in 1960, certain properties were discovered in the yew that were combat cancer. Mm-hmm. So, as I said before, there's reclamation of ancient wisdom, but it's completely abused and denigrated and turned into a biochemical profit, you know, a profit for big pharma. And what has happened is that, you know, many of the yews in the Pacific Northwest were decimated, and because of it, ironically, they were being decimated anyway. They were regarded as being trash trees that were not of any value whatsoever, and they were just being trashed. And it was the plight of an owl that saved them from getting further trash. But then when suddenly it was discovered in the 60s, or later actually, that 60s was a discovery, but it was discovered that, my goodness, hold on to these trees because they are going to make us money. They were then protected in some respects, and it takes the bark of six yews for one person's cancer treatment per year. So you can see the kind of level of devastation that has taken place.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
In India, India's lost upwards of 90%, I think, of its yews because of the need for taxanes. They need the need for this. So, of course, the usual story, go elsewhere and destroy somebody else's habitat to take what you need. So that's what's been happening. And in Britain, they're trying to synthesize it through needles of bushes, so not to destroy the ancient trees. But another thing which is a problem is that the genome is being manipulated to grow the trees faster in these big nurseries that are now being developed, these great big nurseries to keep up with demand. So these nurseries are being developed. They're being forced to grow faster. And what that's happening is it's distorting the gene pool, which is meaning that it's ultimately going to affect the oldest trees as well. So the gene pool is being distorted and manipulated, and that's another cause for concern. It's a great concern that this great being who's constantly sacrificed itself to us throughout history is again having to go through another sacrifice for us. But we mustn't lose the last of these trees. They must remain, because they are a doorway.
Yes, and they must remain as they are and not genetically altered. Oh, my goodness. You know, there used to be a saying, who was it, Shakespeare, that said, kill all the lawyers? And I'm in this age, I'm kind of like, kill all the scientists, because they're destroying the world. So,
well, I think, I mean, it's really true. I mean, you know, in terms of big pharma and the kinds of profit-driven situation that we're in now, I wonder what can be done. I think that's my mission, and certainly the EU pushed me over to this country from Scotland, where I was kind of quite comfortable, to be honest. But I feel that I'm over here in as much as I can, as much as it's possible for one human being to spread the message of the legacy of this ancient being that is among us, that can be used for incredible healing without resorting to manipulation.
Yes, cutting it or using its physical.
Yes, it demands us the healing. It's offering us a route to a new kind of consciousness, and that's really the big picture.
Thank you so much for joining us today. It's just been a pleasure to hear you explain all of these things, and you know, we're at this junction of time where we're entering a new 26,000 year age, and it's like we've come full circle somehow, and we're returning to the wisdom that was ancient, and you are here to bring that forth about the tree, so I want to thank you for that.
Thank you, Carly. It's always a great pleasure speaking with you.
Okay, have a great day, and thank you. And for all my listeners, stay tuned. I'll be on again in 2 weeks, and I have a surprise guest for you. It's going to be something wonderful, so be sure and tune in. Until then, may the sun kiss your face, may the waters bless your body, and may all nature sing in your presence.